May it be so. Let this be a house of peace. Easter can be such a struggle for Unitarian Universalists. One wonders sometimes why we even worry about it, given our inclination to reject the idea of a bodily resurrection, though we often consider the idea of resurrection, of rebirth, in all kinds of metaphorical ways. We consider the ways, for example, that we die and are reborn all the time, the Easter promise that whatever goes down will come up. Spring, for example, all things buried find new ways to bloom again. Nature, like our hope, springs eternal. We Unitarian Universalists have found other ways to acknowledge loss and celebrate the new, rather than return to a story that, at the very least, is unsettling and layered with images of suffering, too often a home for guilt and dis-ease. But I think we do away with the Jesus story at a loss. In our haste to eschew the message that no longer serves us, of the explanation of a mystery, the missing body, that would attach us to a miracle we can't accept, namely the resurrection, we lose the opportunity to consider the players, or at least the main player, what his goal was to begin with, and how the whole thing has been managed or shaped or changed by its history. Throwing the baby out with the bathwater does not serve us, perhaps. Some of you know I'm a fan of revisiting scripture, not because I believe the written word, but because I think it can help us understand ourselves and the water we continue to swim in. We'll be talking more about that water over the next few weeks or more, but today I want to focus on the understanding part. I've mentioned to a few people a sign I noticed recently on a Facebook post. It was a picture of a young woman at some kind of protest or march, and the sign she was holding said something about justice and then, "Know your history." That's what stuck with me. Know your history. If you want to understand the world we live in now and how it's working or not working well, know your history. In this part of the world, we are a product of hundreds, perhaps thousands of years of biblical relationship, of some kind of relationship or other. So much of our culture, our cultural assumptions, our practices, our motivations come out of this tome of a book and the ways it has been interpreted and framed by everyone who has found value or purpose in it or usefulness of some kind. Can we get through life without it? Of course, many do. But there is a particular path to freedom of awareness, of insight provided by understanding the impact of its stories. Who has shaped them, and why, and how? It takes time and attention, but like our staircase travelers suggested, we have to be careful about saving time and losing life. There is magical color and sparkle and imagination in these stairways, venues to not just self-awareness, but system awareness and growth. So, because it's Easter, let's talk a little bit more about Jesus. He has certainly received a lot of attention over the last 2,000 years. And there are infinite interpretations of the story of his life and his death, not to mention the spiritual and political ramifications of that story, or those stories. In 1993, a book was published called The Five Gospels. It was published on the work of the Fellows of the Jesus Seminar. I wonder if any of you may be familiar with it. It's Consideration was the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and then they also included the Gospel of Thomas. Their task was to parse away the layers of fog that surround biblical verse to determine, as best they could, what Jesus might really have said in those books. And they color-coded scripture to help us as follows. Anything in the book, and it's quite thick, that's printed in black, Jesus did not likely say. Anything printed in gray, he also did not likely say, but the ideas were close to his own. If it's printed in pink, Jesus probably said something like it. And what was printed in red, that's Jesus. The book is more than 500 pages long, and I could count on two hands at the most, the pages that had red ink on them. And this was 6 years of study, so they were looking very hard. So if one gives credence to their work, there is a lot in the Bible that is attributed to Jesus that was not necessarily his. We've got an entire mythology built up around his life and his death, and very little, apparently, to give him actual credit for saying. And it is telling, I think, that one of the red passages, one of the "that's Jesus" passages, has been represented for years as advice of fairly passive response. So I want to work with that text a little bit this morning. In Matthew chapter 5, and there's a similar verse in Luke, Jesus says, "Don't react violently against the one who is evil. When someone slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other as well. When someone wants to sue you for your coat, let that person have your cloak along with it. Further, when anyone conscripts you 1 mile, go an extra mile." I wonder if this passage is familiar to any of you, or any of the words within it. How many among you have interpreted the phrase, "turn the other cheek," as an exhortation to accept an act of aggression, to forgive, and even to invite another? Commonly imagined. And if someone wants your coat, to be so generous as to give your cloak as well, and the extra mile, go further than asked or expected. I actually found an article that said, "Go the extra mile and succeed in life." How we have internalized these messages. I suspect these are not uncommon interpretations of what the Jesus Seminar suggests are most likely the messages Jesus would actually have offered, though perhaps not the message he intended. Today, on a day when we consider the seed of life that might surprise us, when we wonder about taking the time to experience a hidden stairway full of magic and sparkle, let me offer you a challenge to the assumptions we have culturally embedded of these gospel messages. Much of the thinking I want to share with you this morning comes from Walter Wink, professor of biblical interpretation at Auburn Theological Seminary, who helps us to understand Jesus speaking in response to power dynamics, asking the question of how we should respond to acts of what we might think of as evil or oppression. When someone slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other as well. In Jesus' day, the use of the right and left hands was very prescribed. The left hand was for issues of cleanliness only. You can project that meaning. The right hand was the expression of capacity, the open hand of welcome to an equal, the backhand of power to someone less than. Jesus is clear that he is talking about a situation of power differential. If struck by the backhand of the oppressor, turn the other cheek. That is, force the oppressor to expose their palm, the symbol of equality. It costs nothing at the time to strike an inferior, but the fine was high for striking an equal. Jesus' suggestion in response to evil was neither fight nor flight, but a nonviolent path of resistance, of defiance, exposing the evil, the offense, for what it was. So imagine the backhand of a right hand lands on your right cheek. If you are struck on the right cheek, turn the other. Turning the other robs the oppressor of the power to humiliate, neither passive nor accepting. Does that feel different to what we might have understood? The second example requires an understanding of borrowing and the costs of repayment at the time. If you were poor and gave your coat as collateral for a loan because it's all you had left, Jewish law required its return every evening at sundown, for that was all the poor had to sleep in. If your creditor took you to court and you gave your cloak as well as Jesus recommended, leaving you basically unclothed, that is, naked, imagine the public reaction. Nakedness was taboo in Judaism, and shame fell not only on the naked party, but on the person viewing or causing one's nakedness. So our Bible readers will remember in the Hebrew scriptures the story of Noah being seen naked by his son and the results of that. Not good ones. The creditor is revealed to be not respectable and not a respectable moneylender, but a party in the reduction of an entire social class to landlessness and destitution. Again, what Jesus recommends is neither passive nor accepting, but exposing oppression, exposing evil for what it is. Wink tells the story of a group of women in apartheid South Africa whose shantytown was going to be destroyed. The soldiers waited until most of the people in the shantytown had gone to work and then announced to anyone left there that they had 5 minutes to gather their belongings before the bulldozers destroyed their town. The women, perhaps sensing the prudery of the farm boys, he says, who largely made up the army, stood in front of the bulldozers and stripped off all their clothes. And the army fled. And third, the extra mile. When anyone conscripts you 1 mile, go an extra mile. It's so interesting how this one also has become something so entirely different from what it was likely intended to be. Know your history, remember? Roman soldiers were limited as to the amount of forced labor they could impose on subject peoples. Like the Jews, for example, mile markers were par for the course along their highways. They were organized and meticulous, and a soldier could require a civilian to carry his pack, likely 75 or 80 pounds of wares, 1 mile, but only 1 mile. To go on meant severe penalties for the soldier under existing military law. So Jesus says, keep going. And how brilliant is that? The soldier, not wanting a fine, says, okay, stop. You've gone a mile, stop. And the civilian says, oh, no, really, let me go on. The question is not winning. It's providing a nonviolent way that the oppressed can recover the initiative. How, Wink reminds us, they can assert their human dignity in a situation that cannot, for the time being, be changed. This teaching, Wink tells us, far from being a counsel of perfection unattainable in this life, is a practical, strategic measure for empowering the oppressed. It provides a hint of how to take on the entire system in a way that unmasks its essential cruelty and to burlesque its pretensions to justice, law, and order. So how is it, we wonder, that these ideas, this small paragraph of text, out of so many that have been asserted as really attributable to Jesus, how have they come to be so misunderstood, so transformed as to infer a passive and powerless acceptance of the status quo. We consider the source. The King James Bible, for example, interpreted from its original by messengers of a monarchy whose interests are not in having the oppressed speak up. Who has been in charge of framing the question for us? Who of us stands to lose from an empowered, oppressed community? There was a time when liberation theology suggested just this dynamic, and yet how quickly those voices were quieted. Yes, Jesus was a peacemaker, and he would have this house, as our choir reminded us this morning, be a house of peace, of the love we strive for together. But Jesus was also an agitator, a fighter against a system that abused many for the sake of a few. That feels like the part of this story we often forget, because in many respects, we are among the few. Jesus was an advocate for a radical love, a life of freedom for all people that said we should all be on the same page in this life. He was an equalizer. And if we don't take the time to remember that, to experience that hidden staircase, to let the seeds of that mystery grow, we will miss his message, what little of it there may actually have been preserved. We will miss altogether. Easter may be for us a day of awakening, a day of recognizing that we are not bound to patterns of inequality, that loving confrontation can free both the oppressed from submissiveness and the oppressor from offense, from expanded systems of offense. It's a radical kind of freedom, and it's not the easy path, but it's a hopeful path. A path to freedom for all of us if we are willing to stay on it despite the risk. Let's enter this morning with hope, with possibility, and with a renewed Easter conviction.